Hi, it's Tony Bruschi from Real Ghost Stories Online, inviting you to subscribe to our other podcast called The Grave Talks. It's where I sit down and interview individuals who've had extreme paranormal situations happen to them in their lives. Just search The Grave Talks on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Be sure to press subscribe and give us some stars to help spread the word that this show exists. Now, here's a 15-minute preview of The Grave Talks. Today on The Grave Talks, the ghosts of CLO Drive. Decades of murder, tragedy, and sorrow seem to follow the path of CLO Drive. History takes the dark stories all the way back to the time when Native Americans inhabited the land. As time would progress, many other souls would live their final days on CLO Drive, including Sharon Tate and the spot where she was murdered. In the late 1990s, David Omen and his father decided to call CLO Drive home and began building a house on this infamous road. He would soon discover that his new home may hold the spirits of a tragic past.
The literally the Native Americans made an incursion on the landholder that was literally was about a mile from my house where the Native Americans and this Mexicans basically had a battle. And three Native Americans were killed and left there in the Walnut Grove, only to be discovered and uncovered in 1925 when ground was broken for the Beverly Hills First Woman's Club. And this ties into the story where I was told by different people, you know, I want to say 100 years later, but let's say 1920. So about 80 years later, when we bought the lot, people, friends of mine, were coming up here saying, you know, they felt Native American presence. And I'm like, oh, yeah, shut the fuck. You know, I was so dismissive of it because I was like, sure, you're psychic and you're picking up Native Americans. They said, get off your gosh darn peyote buttons. And it turns out, literally a few years later, I found out that these Native Americans were actually here. And that's when I discovered and heard the story of the uncovering of the bones of the three Native Americans a mile from the house. And then uncovered the whole backstory of the 1842 battle. And then it was like, oh, shit. Then Lisa Williams trips into the house in 2006 and ends up telling me that there's a Native American she feels whose body is somewhere, her remains are somewhere in the side of the hill upon which this house is built.
Wow.
So it was like, wait a second. It's a Native. And that's when it was all came together after Lisa told me that I had this. You know, I found out this information from the Benedict Canyon Association from their monthly, their biannual newsletter. And it was like, oh, no, Lisa Williams was right. These people and friends of mine were absolutely correct about Native American energies here, that there were Native Americans here. So it was like history actually crossed paths with the paranormal.
Yeah. I mean, it's information that I suppose we could almost say that in about many, many areas of where Native Americans had once been. But when you have the battles and you have the tragedy and the heartbreak that happened on specific pieces of land, were you able to, or was she able to get that information and cross-reference it with any existing Native American tribes or organizations about the battle and about the bodies that may be there?
Well, the battle is separate from here. The battle just corroborated her story when she said in 2006 that she felt Native American, that there was one who has died. It was separate from the battle. He died by accident. Apparently, as according to her story, he was walking on what is now the driveway, which was a horse path to the end of the driveway, which is a plateau that looked out upon the downward part of the canyon. And what was interesting is every gosh darn psychic that had been around here said that they felt this land, this hillside, had very, very strong energy. And it was like, oh, great. And they said, where this Native American possibly was going to, it made sense why he was up here then. I was like, oh, great. But he happened to fall and off of his horse, and the horse came down the hillside and broke both of their necks when they tumbled down the slope, and they stopped. And their bodies were left there for 200 years, so to speak, And through the course of time, they were covered by the mudslides and the movement of the earth around here. And the remains were literally interred in the earth under this mountain that I live on.
So that's one of the initial documented tragedies of this area.
Yeah. And the Native Americans, again, that was something that was documented by the woman who owned the 4,500 acres, which included Benedict Canyon, all of Beverly Hills, all the way down to Culver City, all the way out to, like, I forgot exactly where, it was probably about 30 miles east of downtown LA, that she owned the whole swath of land. That her husband, who had died was a commissioned officer in the Mexican army, they deeded that land to her. Mm-hmm. And that included all of this hillside and all of the mountains here. And the canyon, Benedict Canyon, was all walnut groves that she had developed. And the Native Americans were forced up into the canyons, and they would come down and do raids. I guess they do, stash and grab raids of her ranch, which was over on Sunset and Alpine, about a little over a mile and a half away from where we are right now. And on this occasion in 1842, her ranch hands were basically sick and tired of having to deal with the theft of livestock and produce, so that they actually mounted an aggressive attack to put this to an end. And that was the last incursion that the Native Americans made on her adobe, or her ranch. And they basically killed three of the Native Americans in that war tribe that came down there on the raid tribe, and were buried on the spot in the middle of the walnut orchard that literally 80 years later was where they started developing the land to build the Beverly Hills First Woman's Club in 1925.
So you have that as the starting point, the area where much development is going to be happening over the next 100, 200 years.
Right.
As things do progress then, and modern society starts to come into fruition, what begins to develop over this plot of land?
On that plot of land, well, where the walnut orchard was, and where the Beverly Hills First Woman's Club in 1925, it was the first built, one of the first, not homes, but municipal buildings that they put up that far north of the city itself. There were homes up here. I mean, Rudolph Valentino's home was being built at the time. Greystone Manor and Pickfair were being built. But it was pretty much a rural area where in 1925, it was just starting to be developed. So that's the whole thing. And I did find out the name of the tribe. The name of the tribe that was in Southern California in this area and covered a pretty good portion of it for about 10,000 years was the Tongva tribe, T-O-N-G-V-A. And I have done research on them, and unfortunately it's a sad state of affairs that it's one of many of the tribes, or the nations, as the Native Americans would call themselves, that were usurped and removed and displaced as a result. And what I found in my research about the Native Americans is that most every part of the United States that we occupy was occupied by some tribe or some nation of Native Americans. I mean, it's just, the research I did just blew my mind. I didn't realize how prolific these people were. And it's like the story of the story of Columbus discovering anything. As I do more and more research, I start to realize he discovered shit. Mm-hmm. It's a total misnomer what he discovered. He took upon himself to lay claim to it, but it's like, it's a different story when you talk about who was the first person on the planet, the moon. Fine and dandy. There was no humans there ever. Mm-hmm. Here in the United States, there were humans everywhere. They occupied and ran the country in small little, bands and groups and nations. So the fact that what he found was nothing. He discovered another country where people were living that were ready and able to be enslaved, brutalized, tormented, theft, stolen from, etc. So that's why I found that the Native Americans that were here of this tribe were not and did not look like the Plains Indians, as Zach Bagans, elicits in the show Ghost Adventures, they weren't running around with headdresses made of eagle feathers and wearing leather clothes made out of buffalo, because buffalo was an indigenous species and to the Native Americans who were in the Midwest, in the plains. But in the West, they didn't have buffalo, so they weren't making teepees. The Native Americans here lived in huts made of branches and twigs and such. And their headdresses, which they did have, because we have photographs of them, were made out of wood logs, and they were carved, intricately carved, you know, headdresses out of a chunk of wood, a tree trunk. It was amazing. So they used what was indigenous and close proximity to them for their use. So it's a matter of, they dressed in the clothes and what they could gather from what was abundant locally. There was deer and wolf and bears and mountain lions. So their clothes were made from the indigenous species of the animals locally, so to speak. It wasn't like they had dresses made out of leather, but it was made out of deer skin. Mm-hmm. And it was different. It opened my mind to understand how deeply ignorant we are about our surroundings and the history of our areas. And when people said things and I scoffed them, I turned around and thought to myself, boy, I'm a bigger idiot than I thought. I don't know anything about my own area past 100 years ago.
Well, a lot of it is what we're taught, and we're not taught that much in our education system, unless as adults we go and dig deeper and deeper and deeper into what reality was.
Right. It's true, and it opened my mind up. So it gave me a deeper sense of reverence for the Native American, whether or not he was here, according to Lisa Williams, or not. I wanted to be able to show reverence to him, because I thought that if he's here, oh boy, this is more sacred ground to him, because this is where he died and his remains are interred. So I've always shown a certain integrity and respect towards that individual or that spirit, since I found out, you know, the story about the Native Americans and their, I guess, the displacement and their hardships that they went through when living up in this area long before I even existed.
Sure.
So to me, it was just an interesting story. When she told me this, I was like, okay. I said, now, if this is true, other psychics that come into this area of the house, the earthen wall room under the third level, if they pick it up, this should be interesting. So I'm going to keep it under my hat and keep quiet about it and let anybody that goes in there tell me without tipping my hand and telling them a story and keeping it in the public. I kept it under wraps so that every time a psychic would come in, like James Von Prague, who went in there with Larry King Live, or Marianne Winkowski, or there was also Jackie Barrett from America's Psychic Challenge. When each one of these people went in there, I didn't say a word. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they got in there, it was almost instantaneous. They all said at one point or another, saying, I feel the presence of a Native American. Now, what's interesting is they didn't say it in plural. They said a Native American singular. Mm-hmm. I didn't say a word to them of any sort. So whatever they're picking up, they're picking up on their own. And I'm like, okay, tell me more. And then they would say, he's in here. And in some cases, it was an uncomfortable sensation that would then, as we say, take over the conversation. And in James Von Prague's case, it was like, he said, I don't feel very comfortable in here. I want to get out of here. Let's get out of here. And just left right after about 25 seconds in that room, which is telling to me. I don't know what that means, but I definitely made note of these experiences that every time I brought somebody in there and they would come up with a response, and then the follow-up was, I'm okay, or no, I want to be out of this room. I really don't feel comfortable. Let's go.
I hope you enjoyed your 15-minute preview of our new podcast, The Grave Talks. Be sure to subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download podcasts to not miss any episode of the show. New episodes every single Monday. Just search for The Grave Talks and then press subscribe. Give us a review while you're at it and some stars that will help us grow in the rankings and let other folks know that the show exists to make an even better show for you. The Grave Talks. Check it out at thegravetalks.com.